chapter 1. This is lesson 2 in the series that we're doing. We've been going through the minor prophets, and all of them have been just really informative. I've enjoyed them all. I especially enjoy Habakkuk here and some of the things that he's talking about. He has some questions that we all have. He asks those things that really weighs on all of our minds from time to time. You know, if we've ever asked questions like, God, why did the Holocaust take place? Why does things like 9/11 happen? Why does it appear that good people tend to suffer and bad people tend to get by with it? Certainly, if we read through the Proverbs, we find this recurring theme that it seems to say that if we do right, if we do according to the will of God, we'll prosper. If the wicked's going to suffer justice, it's going to be imposed upon them. And, you know, it draws us into questions. If we've ever had those questions, we're not alone. Those have been questions that people have asked since the beginning of time. You know, since the beginning or the fall of man, I'm sure that Adam and Eve had those questions in their mind from time to time. Certainly their children and beyond them, all the way up through the ages, and including here with Habakkuk, as he looks around and he sees all that's going on in his own nation and the surrounding nations, he takes time to just ask, you know, what's going on and wants to know of God. Now, I want to point out that when Habakkuk does this, he does it in a very reverent way. Now, it's all right to question things. Now, we never question the sovereignty of God, and we never make false accusations of him. We never defame his name or misrepresent him. But at the same time, it is all right to ask questions. God, why is this going on? We'll see Habakkuk does this. He never crosses over that line. But once again, we went in the introduction last week. But to give the settings in the area and the time around what we're getting ready to read about tonight, around 605 B.C., and the century preceding that time, Frank, the Assyrians were the dominant power of the world. They were the ones that were from nation to nation. They were the ones that were overtaken, ruling with power, with violence. They would go into countries and they would just have their way with them. They were also the ones that went into the northern kingdom and took the northern kingdom captive. They would have went into the southern kingdom, but if you'll remember in 2 Kings chapter 19, the angel of the Lord went out before them that night, and 185,000 of the Assyrian soldiers was slew by that one angel. And that kind of turned them away to where they went away. So after the Assyrian Empire, I'll get ahead of myself here, after the Assyrian Empire started to wind down a little bit, there was a new empire. There's always going to be a new empire. There's always going to be a new power, a new person in charge, and it started to be the Babylonians. We'll see them here called the Chaldeans, but nonetheless, the Babylonians start to rise in power. It was the Babylonians in 612 that overthrew Nineveh. Nineveh was Assyria's capital, so Assyria had to move their capital, and they moved it over to a place called Hebron. And certainly a few years later, I think it was about 610, a couple years later, about 610, the Babylonians defeated that as well, forcing them over once again to Carchemish. Now, Carchemish is an important city, and you can read about this. You may want to write this down. I didn't put it in your outline. 2 Chronicles chapter 35, right around verse 20 or so, but the whole chapter, you can go back and read it. Carchemish was for the Assyrian capital was at, and Egypt was coming up to help the Assyrians. Babylonians were getting ready to attack it, so the Egyptians started to come up. Pharaoh Necho, that he started to come up with his forces in order to go to Carchemish. And as they started to go, the Egyptians came out and withstood against them. Josiah went out even against the will of God in this. Now, Josiah was basically a good king, and he tried to do things right, but this is one time where he disobeyed God. He disobeyed God's voice, and he went out and he withstood against Egypt. Well, the Babylonians, they overtook Carchemish, and now they saw what Egypt was trying to do, so they turned their forces toward the south and go down to to Egypt and overthrow Egypt. This is the battles that we're going to read about, or we're going to see kind of a little bit of a nod to them in Habakkuk. But after they took over in Egypt, that basically secured their place as a world power. So now you can imagine, if you're looking at Israel, the Middle East, and looking at the Fertile Crescent all around, the northern kingdom is now taken over by Babylon. The east, the way, all through the desert, Sinai, all the area over to the east of Israel is occupied by the Babylonians. Now we have the Babylonian south. So you have this small little southern kingdom of Israel right in the middle of this great nation of Assyria. So Babylon. So the Babylonians, people knew who they were. This is about the time frame, and this is what Habakkuk was looking at when he sees this. But now, as we get into the reading of Habakkuk, I want to make sure that we understand that Habakkuk here in the first chapter, and the first five verses or so, is not talking about the Babylonians. He's talking about his own countrymen. He's talking about Israel. Now, it's another thing I want us to really keep track of as we're reading through the book of Habakkuk is when Habakkuk stops talking and God starts talking. Because it makes a huge difference when we realize who's the one that's doing the communication, who's the one that's doing the talking here. So let's go ahead and just read the first chapter. In fact, let's go ahead and read through chapter 2 and verse 1. And we'll just start up here with Kim, if you'll read, say, four verses, and then we'll just jump around and go from there, if you would, please.
That's fine. We're going to stop right there tonight. Just going through chapter 2 and verse 1.
I know that we have the chapter markers and so on here, but I really think that chapter 2 and verse 1 kind of belongs with this. You'll see, even when we get into chapter 2, how it kind of starts this different discourse. And Habakkuk is going to say, he's asking this same question throughout. How long? How long, O Lord, are you going to allow this to happen? How long are you going to let this take place before you do something? Look at what's around. And he may reword his question. Have you ever had somebody come and ask you a question, and then you give them the answer, and it wasn't the answer they want, so they rephrase their question to ask you again, but effectively they're asking the exact same question? How many has children? We know that happens, and then you try to give them the answer again, and yet it still doesn't satisfy, so they rephrase their question, and they ask it again. And we're going to see Habakkuk is going to do this. He cries out, how long? One of the messages that we're going to get from the book of Habakkuk, and that we should get as well as Habakkuk, is that God's timing is not our timing. How many in here wish that God's timing was according to our timetable and our time scale? You know, sometimes we think that we want God to act, and we want God to act now. I love Thomas Paine. He said, patience, I have no patience for patience. That's about the way I feel about it sometimes. But yet, God's understanding of time is not like our understanding of time. In fact, his understanding is not like our understanding. I love to think about it like looking at a big Thanksgiving table or a Christmas table, and you've got all your settings across this table. Just imagine a big table that sets 10, 12, 15 people. And looking across the table, you've got a turkey, and you've got the dressing, and you've got the mashed potatoes and the yams and all the different things. But we're like little kids. We're standing right on the edge of the table looking across it. And all we can see is just a few little things that are right there in front of us. But we don't realize that behind the yams, we have this wonderful turkey. And behind that turkey, we have other side dishes and other things. But if we could just simply stand up and look across the table, then we can see all the good things that are there. We're like that in comparison to the way God is in our lives. All we see is what's right here. It's hard for us to see 10 years, 20 years down the road. It's hard for us to understand what ramifications, what might happen today, may affect tomorrow. We live right now. We live for what's going to take place today. We make our decisions based on that. But God is more interested in things that are going to happen, things that take place over a period of time. So when Habakkuk sees what's going on in the first four verses here, he's wanting to know, why, God, why are you not doing something about this? Why are you not responding to this? But like I said, God's timing is not ours. Galatians chapter 4, I think it's about verse 7 when it tells us about the coming of Christ. When the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of woman, made under the law, to redeem them that are under the law. It was when that fullness of time was come, not when people wanted it to be. And so Habakkuk is going to learn this great question here. And, the same question, as I said, is repeated throughout verse 12 through 17. Habakkuk starts to point out that God is just, and he also points to the wickedness of the world and the people that are there, and not so many words, once again, asking him the same question, why? You see, that also, the verse that we read in chapter 2 and verse 1, is almost, I'm going to wait and see. What are you going to do? Why are you doing this? Habakkuk says, I cried out. And Habakkuk does have the wrong idea about God here about this one thing. He thinks God is not hearing him. And I'll tell you, in the midst of our troubles, in the midst of tribulations, in the midst of persecution, it's easy for us to think that God doesn't hear what we're saying, that he doesn't hear our prayers. Remember, Daniel prayed and he wanted the Lord to send help. And it says that he prayed for 21 days. I think it's in Daniel chapter 10. But when the angel of the Lord finally got to him, he said, I've been delayed. I've been fighting, but I've heard you the very first day that you cried out. The nation of Israel was enslaved. And when God finally appeared to Moses in the burning bush, you remember what he said about that? I've heard the cries of my people, and I've seen their afflictions. So see, he was sending Moses to take care of this problem. If you were in Egypt at the time, you may be thinking to yourself, where's God in all this? I thought we were God's people. Why is he not hearing our prayers? And so Habakkuk here is asking this same question. You know, how long shall I cry and now not hear me? How long am I going to do this? David understand the right idea about God hearing. In the 40th Psalm, David basically says, I cried unto the Lord and he inclined unto me, that he heard me. I love the word inclined. I use it a lot because it's a beautiful word. But how many of us have ever had a flower in a room or a plant and it starts to lean toward the light? We've done that, right? Sometimes the flower pots out here in front. I will get out there and I will rotate them around in the summertime when we're getting, because they'll get really full on one side and the other side seems a little bit, because everything is going toward the sun. It's inclined to the sun. And that's the same word that David is using in the 40th Psalm. But God is inclined toward us, and he does hear. Just because we don't get an answer right away doesn't mean that God does not hear us. So that's the one thing Habakkuk did have kind of wrong in his theology. But in the rest of it, he's pretty well spot on, I think, in a lot of it. That he understands the character of God. He understands the righteousness, the holiness of God. He just doesn't understand exactly what all that means. He tells him in verse 3, you know, why do you let me see this? I'm in the midst of all this wickedness. You caused me to behold this. And Habakkuk was asking God simply, why do I have to be a witness to all of this? Why do I have to see all of this? Have we ever wondered that question in our own mind? Have we ever seen disasters? Have we ever seen problems? Have we ever seen families? I was downtown today, and there was a guy that came into the room that I was at. He was asking for 50 cents to get on to the bus. And, you know, we see this. I remember the first time I ever saw a homeless person. I remember it. It's something that just stuck with me. Now, we're from the country, and there was poor people in the country, but poor people in the country having a lot better off than poor people in the city. That's just the way it is. In the country, you have. And in the city, you don't. I remember I was with a pastor friend of mine, Brother David Bullock, and Chris St. John. Scott Pastor was another one that was there with us. And Daniel Davis, all these, there were three or four godly men that was with me. And we were walking through New York, and I remember seeing this guy reach down into a trash can, picked up a cup of Starbucks coffee. It still had a little bit in it, and finished drinking it off. I got to tell you, I still don't even drink after Kim all that much. And we've been married for, 15 years, Bob decent. We've been married for quite a while. But for me to see that, I remember it just really affected me. and to see other things that we saw. And so Habakkuk's crying out, and he's like, well, why do you let me see these things? Why are you allowing me to be witnesses of these? After all, if we go back to what we looked at last week, Habakkuk was probably a temple worker, a priest of some sort, working in the music or something. Why would he have to be witnesses to that? Lamentations 35 verse 51 basically says, mine eye hath affecteth mine heart. What we see affects the way we feel. This is why if missionaries can ever get people to come on the mission trip with them, can ever get them to come to a foreign country, they've got supporters for the rest of their ministry there. Right, Brother David? You've seen that where missionaries want to kind of see what we're dealing with. See what we're putting up with. I mean, I've talked to missionaries. I've talked to people who've went on mission trips that's come back with no shoes on their feet because they've given to the people that were there that they couldn't wait to get back on the mission field to do other stuff. It affects you in a very profound way. When we see things, it affects what we feel. And so I think God allows him in part to see that. How many have seen that commercial on television where the guys, it was produced by a Christian company, or a church, and a guy was just getting ready to go to work or getting ready to go to town. He's going to stop and get him a cup of coffee, and as he starts to back out of his driveway, the little kid bounces in front of him and frustrates him. He drives down the road, and somebody cuts him off, and just I believe it was filmed in Lexington. I really do. Because by the time he got there, he'd already witnessed all these different things. And somebody cuts in line in front of him. And it's just, I feel for the man because I have days just like that. And then as he was sitting there, somebody just walked up to him and gave him a pair of glasses. And as he put the glasses on, all of a sudden over everybody just came a little title. And he looked at a woman over here and it said divorce. And he looked at a guy over here struggling financially. Looked at a guy in the back and it said just lost his job. And then he walked outside and he started to see these words over everybody. And he started to realize these were people with problems too. And when we see these things, they affect us on that very intimate, fundamental level. Jude says if we want to make a difference, have compassion on people. And when we start to see them in their situation, in the state that they're in, it's easier for us to have compassion on them. What was the kind of things that Habakkuk saw here? He mentions about grievance. Trouble or toils, worrying, the weary efforts as it goes down, the word grievance there, the spoilings is to be ravished or to be oppressed or even to be robbed. The violence is literally cruelty that's there. He says the law is slack, it's sluggish, it just doesn't seem to move the way it's supposed to move. After all, the law was supposed to govern them. The law was supposed to be what they lived by and allowed them to have a peaceful nation that ran smoothly. But yet, the law seemed to be very sluggish. There was strife and contention. There was these problems amongst the people. Judgment failed, it says. It says its judgment is paralyzed. Have you ever felt like that in this country, that judgment is paralyzed? It just fails. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Wicked surrounds, of course, not only talking about his nation there, but also the nations around. Wrong judgments are passed. How many of us have watched and we've seen episodes on television that maybe a high-profile courtroom case, and you just know that the person is guilty of sin. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure it out. If you take the common sense approach, you know that they're guilty. But if you follow the little legalese and all the little caveats and stuff that they do, then you people get by with crime. And you look at it and you're like, you're kidding me. How could you let this person go back into society knowing what they've done? Well, a cop broke a law or a cop violated some civil code that they had, and then this person is freed. That wrong judgment passes, it comes down. You know, and you ask, is there any reason or is there any wonder why he would question God like this? Well, also notice the entire time that he's always remained, and he remains throughout the book, very reverent to God, never making those accusations to him. And I just want to really emphasize that we can question, but let us be very careful to not defame the name of God. I tried to look it up. I forget exactly where it was at. It's not written in such plain language as that. But I remember one person that God really came down on them hard because they misrepresented his character and who he was. And I'll have to find that and bring that back to us at one point in time. Hopefully before Habakkuk's done, I'll come across that again. But I just remember reading that story and thinking how very profound that was, that God is not going to allow his name to be that way. So the question is asked here by Habakkuk, and you know, we accept by faith that God is just, right? Don't we believe that God is just? Habakkuk believed that he was. Isn't God holy and righteous? Do we believe that? Habakkuk believed that he was, but yeah, he sees these things going on and he has this question. So God gets ready to respond to him. And he tells him in verse 5 there, you know, behold you among the heathen and regard the wonders marvelous, for I will work a work in your day which ye will not believe, though it be told you. If we just took that verse right there, that may sound pretty good to us, mightn't it? I'm going to do something that you're not going to believe. We generally think the best of verses like that, and we've got to be very cautious about that. If we're saying we're going to do something, well, let me just say first, God does respond to Habakkuk with a statement. He says, both I hear you and I'm getting ready to do something about you in the midst of other nations. God still hears. And what's about to be done is just simply unbelievable. So what is unbelievable? If we ask that question that God is getting ready to do something unbelievable, I think generally because we understand the character and the person of God, we think of something gigantic, something enormous, something that is just on a scale that is beyond what we can comprehend, right? That God is getting ready to do something great. To me, you tell me that God's getting ready to do something great at Fairhaven Baptist Church, my mind instantly goes to revival's getting ready to break out. People's lives are going to be changed and saved. We're going to have a great communion with God in this day and time. We're going to see the neighborhood turned around. That's the way I think about something unbelievable. It's hard for me to believe that God is going to do that, but I look forward to it and I want that to happen. So that's generally the way, I mean, are we most of us like that when I say something, we're going to do something very unbelievable? How many of our husbands will come in here and say, they call their wife and the wife says, I got something unbelievable fixed for you at home. And we instantly think, man, she's got her lasagna fixed or she's got that cheesecake fixed or something great and spectacular, something wonderful. And certainly, that's unbelievable, but yet, unbelievable can go to the negative side as well, can it? That I'm going to do something that you just simply can't believe. That because of your concept or your understanding of who I am may limit you in understanding what I can and what I'm willing to do here. It's unbelievable to think that I could take oxygen, a main component of fire, and a fuel like hydrogen that is a very flammable gas, and combine them together to make something that'll put out fire. To me, that's unbelievable that God can do that, but yet he can. It's something that we don't normally think that can happen. It's somewhat negative. And this is what's getting ready to be told to Habakkuk here. That, for instance, it's unbelievable that the Babylonian, or it's believable, I should say, that the Babylonian could take over the Southern Empire, right? We can believe that, but it's unbelievable to think that God would kind of orchestrate that a little bit. It's completely understandable to believe that. Is it believable that the nation of Babylon would divide the people, enslave them, and punish them, exile them from their own land? Yeah, that's believable. Why? Because there's evidence of that happening in other places. We look at that and we say, absolutely. But is it believable if God tells us the details of how he's going to deal with the sin that's taking place in Israel, and he says, I'm going to bring the Babylonians into you, and I'm going to allow the Babylonians to conquer your country and to take over your city's power and to exile your kings and your princes. I'm going to allow them to come in. They're going to persecute your people. They're going to enslave. They're going to entrap. They're going to exile your people from the nation. It's a little bit unbelievable. If I was Habakkuk, I would be saying, God? That's not what I asked for you to do. I ask you to do something about the wickedness that has taken place. And God is in a sense saying, I'm going to. I'm fixing to take care of it, and you're not going to believe how I'm going to take care of it here. It's pretty amazing, really. God is just revealing to him, and he tells him the Chaldeans here. Now, the Chaldeans, as I've already said, is another name for the Babylonians. They basically went by that name for several years because of some, I think it was about four of the leaders, actually three. Four were known to be from the Chaldees, but only three of them, I think, were really from that area. But nonetheless, they were known as the Chaldeans. But nonetheless, the Babylonians were a fierce people. God described them. Look through the list here. Verse 6 and 7, he describes them as bitter. Sometimes I joke around at work. We've all heard the jokes about coffee. I say, I like my coffee like my wife, good and bitter. I don't really like her that way. That's not good for me. But he says they're a bitter people and they're a hasty people. Verse 7 says they're terrible. They're dreadful, that they would march through the lands taking it just by force, that they would be living in the homes of the people that were there. That's interesting to me in itself because, you know, in our Constitution, that's one thing that soldiers can't do. Do you know why? In the Revolutionary period, during the Revolutionary War, the British soldiers would just come in, and whatever home they want to live in, they would just go in and move into it. And the colonists were here were basically bound to take them in. So our founding fathers put that in the Constitution, that our soldiers could never be able to do that. But yet, we see in the Word of God here that he's saying the Babylonians, when they march through your land, they're going to take it. Their judgment shall come from themselves. That's a very profound statement in itself, I think, because now, well, what's too hard? What's too hasty? What's too bitter? If it comes from themselves, then they have no moral guidelines by which to limit them. If it comes from a law, or if it comes from even a pagan god, then there's going to be something written that says this is too far. But the human condition and the human character will allow us to go as far as we want. The human heart can be hardened and seared to the point of where we can do anything if we just simply take God out of the equation. There's no pretense that they're even seeking the counsel of God in this. God goes on to describe their way of warfare through these verses. He says their horses are fast. They're faster than the leopards. That they move with just a fierceness of the night wolf. Can you imagine that? I like fantasy movies and stuff. I'm a little geek that way. I can sit and watch some of that stuff, and it's enjoyable to me. It's just relaxing. But I think of some of these movies where the soldier, he'll get on some kind of animal that's not a horse, but it's some kind of monster thing. And this is almost what God is describing. Their horses are faster than leopards. They're more fierce than wolves. The rider shall charge ahead is the way it says there. They're going to just headlong in the battle. They have no fear. They have no worries about them. They're going to go into battle like an eagle heading to its food. Just with the swiftness, with a desire to get there. And they come for the purpose of violence. They shall gather people like picking up sand in verse 9. Can you imagine just reaching down and grabbing a handful of sand? And he says this is the way that they're going to come in and take up the people, take up the nation of Israel and destroy them. They're going to scoff at the kings and the princes. They're not going to give them any honor. They're going to mock them. They're just going to come in and take over. Look at verse 11 with me. So after all this is happening, then it says, then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this to the power unto his small g god. It's essentially saying that his mindset is going to change. I've asked this question in this study several times. I think it's important for us to continue to ask it. If I were to ask you what wind is, what would you say? Anybody have a good working definition of wind? Jennifer, what's wind? There we go. Everybody agree with that? What if you have no concept of what molecules of air are, or oxygen, or what's in the atmosphere? What is wind then? How do we know wind exists? Look at the trees. Feel it blowing across your body. What is it that's blowing across your body? I don't know. What's bending that tree over? I don't know. What's kicking all that dust up? I don't know, but something's kicking it up. There is some power behind the movement of the grass. There's some power behind the bending of that tree. There's some power behind that coolness that's going across my body. In the Old Testament and in the New Testament, the word that is used here is mind, thought, wind, spirit. They didn't really know what wind was. It could be like a ghost, a spirit to them. Just something over there shaking the tree. But when it talks about his mind being changed, here it's talking about that guiding force. Something within him that empowers him to go this way is going to change the way he thinks and the way that he looks at situations and circumstances. And it's going to change it now to where, well, look at what it goes on to say. And he shall pass over, that's transgress, that he is going to run over or transgress the people and offend, imputing his power unto his God. So he's basically going to change his mind and do this thing, running over people and claiming it's for the power or by the power of his small g God. Does that make sense? And this change takes place in him at this point in time. And that's God's answer to Habakkuk. Think about that. That's a very powerful thing. Here Habakkuk is asking God this question. My own countrymen, my own nation, there's violence in it. There's problems here. When are you going to take care of it? And God says, I'm getting ready to do something you're not going to believe. I'm bringing the Babylonian Empire in. This is how I'm going to take care of it. If you're Habakkuk, how do you respond to that? Well, let's just go ahead and look and see here. Habakkuk, starting at, well, about verse 12, he starts to talk about the character of God. And then he's going to compare righteousness of himself to the righteousness of his nation to the righteousness of the Babylonian Empire. And he's in a sense asking, God, do you know who you are? You are everlasting. Surely you know what's going to happen if you do this. I was listening to an apologist today, actually, and he was talking about God being outside time, and he was explaining prophecy. He was explaining the foreknowledge of God in events and talking about God being outside time, that, you know, seeing the beginning, seeing the end is a human concept, the time frame. But and it's kind of essentially basically what Habakkuk is referring to here. You know the beginning from the end. You know what's going to happen. You know what's going to take place. You know what this will result in. If the Babylonians come in here, what do you think is going to happen? You don't even have to be somebody who's very prophetic to know what's going to happen if the Babylonian Empire comes in there. Let me ask you this. If the Taliban takes over a small town in the middle of Iraq, what's going to happen? Now, I'm not a prophet or the son of a prophet, not in that sense, but I can tell you what's going to happen. People are going to be enslaved. People are going to be killed. People are going to be tortured. It's just going to happen. That's what happens when they take over. So Habakkuk is saying, you're everlasting. Don't you know what's going to happen? And then he says, my God, my Holy One. I love that Habakkuk employs the name and the character of God at this point. He goes on to say, you have pure eyes that, you know, you can't even see evil. You don't even want to acknowledge evil in the presence of evil. Why are you going to do this? Why would you allow this to happen? I think he's in a sense asking the question here, is my understanding wrong? Is my understanding of what you're saying wrong? Or is my understanding of who you are wrong? Now, right or wrong, I'm not asking anybody to raise their hands. If you hear this, do you have a theological crisis in your life? We probably do. I mean, we probably do until we understand the fullness of who God is. And I think that we learn that and we see that and we're going to acknowledge that later on throughout this book. But, well, don't we have some kind of theological crisis when God is allowing things to happen that we don't think should happen? It essentially goes back to why does bad things happen? And the question that's there, anyway. Verse 13 is what happens when we start comparing others to herself. And I think it's a argument that is easy enough to make for us sometimes. As if saying, you know, God, I know I'm not perfect, but we're better than they are. How many of us has ever used that argument in our own lives? I may not be perfect, but I'm certainly better than... We can put anybody's name we want to there, can't we? Some of us have to pick famous names to be better than. Others can be better than most people. But nonetheless, it's easy for us to do that. Habakkuk acknowledges the wickedness of Babylon. I mean, look at what Habakkuk says about Babylon as he furthers the argument of the nation of Israel being more righteous than they are. He's pointing out, the way that the Babylonians are. They make men like common beasts. They're not even like human beings to them. When they come through, there's a difference between killing an animal and killing a person. Now, I'm not saying that we need to go out here and just kill animals. I don't believe that in any way. I think that's cruel. And the Word of God tells us that a good man careth for his animal. But at the same time, you know, when we go out and we shoot a rabbit for food, we don't have a great moral crisis of that. Most of us don't, I don't think. Or if we kill another animal, we step on a bug or something like that. It doesn't bother us all that much. But yet, he's saying that the people of Babylon, they treat men like just common beasts. Killing fish or game is the same to them as killing men. They take with them no thought of discrimination. He uses this illustration of being like fishermen that cast the net, and they pull the net back full. How many fishermen pick out the women fish and the baby fish and throw them back in? And he says they just pull them out with no discrimination whatsoever. They don't worry about their age. They don't worry about if they're able to. They're just capturing them all, taking them in. A soldier may have to fight, and they may even have to kill for their duty. But at the moment that the soldier starts enjoying that soldier has a problem. In the United States military, he has not only a moral problem, but he has a legal problem as well. The United States military doesn't want men that cannot separate the killing for duty and in combat from murder. And there is a difference. Even in the Word of God, there's a very big difference there. But yet, these people have become, it says that they are happy for doing it. It's enjoyable to them. You know, so I feel like it's a pretty good argument if you ask me. I'm better than they are. Look at them. This is what they're like. This is what they do. They give thanks in verse 16 to false gods. And he goes back to the fish analogy as well. If they empty their nets with no pity or compassion on anything or anyone that's caught in them. Even a fisherman takes the decency to cast the small ones back. If he cares about his future in fishing, he does. You don't want to put it back in there and let it grow so he can come back. So Habakkuk tries to make this comparison that people of Babylon are more wicked than the people of Israel, and that God should stand on the side of the people of Israel, right? How many think that sounds like a pretty good argument? The problem is, when you compare wicked with less wicked, what do you have? You still have wicked. Just because they're worse than we are doesn't mean that we're righteous. We could talk about their wickedness all day long, but it doesn't produce one ounce of righteousness in me by pointing out how bad they are. Sometimes we get those arguments. Sometimes we think that we can push those through, and certainly we think that we can push those through with God. Keep in mind, all that was taking place in the nation of Israel was because of their disobedience to God, because of their unwillingness to keep the covenant with God. God was clear about his covenant. He said, if you will keep my commandments, if you will obey my words, if you will follow after me, then I will bless you. If not, then I won't. Now, this is a problem some people in theology have, because they think, well, God is making these people do this. Well, no, once again, it's the difference between withholding the bad things and propelling the bad things. Isaiah chapter 5, I think it is, it gives this beautiful illustration of a vineyard. And he starts out by saying, my well-beloved vineyard, I've done all this for you. I've tried to make you pleasant. I've tried to make you beautiful. I've tried to do the right thing. I've gave you the choicest of vines. But when you brought forth fruit, you brought forth wild grapes. He says, therefore will I tear down my wall and let the rains come in and the winds come in and destroy you. Let the environment basically come in. And there's a difference between God bringing the nation of Babylon in and then allowing the nation of Babylon to come in. Does that make sense to you all? And when God removes his hedge of protection, these things are naturally things that are going to happen. God is just going to use those for his benefit. But God is not forcing them to do that. This is the natural result of living in a fallen world. Just like an earthquake is a natural result of living in a fallen world. That it just takes place. It happens because of the world that we live in. If the argument that Habakkuk was making made sense, where would it end? Well, you're going to stand up for me because I'm less wicked than they are. Like I said at the beginning of the study, there's always going to be a greater nation, a greater power to come up. And when a greater power come up that was more wicked than they are, should God stand on the side of the Babylonians against that greater power because the greater power is more wicked? God forbid. Still wicked. This is what happens when we compare ourselves to one another. And we say, well, I'm better than so-and-so. So what? The comparison is not so-and-so. The comparison is not Hitler. The comparison is not Saddam Hussein. Osama bin Laden. The comparison is not me. The comparison is not Kim, Brother Rudell. The comparison is the standard of God, the righteousness of Jesus Christ. And when we compare ourselves to that, then all of a sudden we realize, man, we're all off. We all missed the mark. None of us are where we ought to be. For us to say, well, God, you need to defend me because I'm better than them, just doesn't make sense. I'm still wicked. I need forgiveness. I need to be in the will and in the standard of God. And this was the argument that Habakkuk was bringing forth to God and wanting to understand for him. If we compare ourselves to others, then really, can't we justify anything that we do? After all, we're better than Hitler, right? I'm going to close with this thought as we go on into chapter 2. Habakkuk states, and I will stand upon my watch, and I will set me upon the tower, and I will watch to see what he will say unto me, and what I shall answer when I am reproved. I think Habakkuk knew where he stood here. He knew that the reproving was coming. He knew that this was going to take place. But at the same time, once again, it's going back to answer that. He's asking that same question. I'm going to stand and watch and see if you really will do this and when you're going to answer. And then, of course, in chapter 2, as we go on through it, we're going to see more of this destruction come on. But we're going to see Habakkuk learn the character of God is complete. He's not just merciful, gracious, and long-suffering. Yes, he is those, but he is also a God of judgment. He is God that punishes wickedness. He is a God that has to punish sin by his righteousness. And if we separate either of those, then we don't have a full picture of who God really is. We have any questions or comments on the first chapter?